For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website. Good morning, everyone. And welcome to our newcomers. I want to talk today about a Japanese teaching story. It's not found in our formal any of our formal koan collections, but I think it is a koan anyway. It's a story that you can actually find in Reb Anderson's book Being Upright, and I think it has. Well, there's some things that I want to highlight about our practice. So I'll read it first, and then we'll talk a little bit. The story goes, during the Tokugawa era in Japan, which is in the 1603 to 1868, so somewhere in there, a monk named Tetsugyu, which means iron bull, was serving tea to the warlord of Sendai when his Dharma brother, Choon, or Tidal Sound, dropped by the tea room. Lord Sendai invited Choon to join them for tea. Tetsugyu chose an especially precious antique tea bowl that Lord Sendai had given him and put it down on the tatami mat to make tea. In the midst of the moment of appreciating the great beauty of the tea bowl, Choon suddenly reached out with a ceremonial stick he was carrying and smashed the tea bowl. "Now look at the authentic tea bowl that exists before birth," said Choon. Tetsugyu turned pale and nearly fainted, but Lord Sendai was able to stay present. He said to Tetsugyu, "I gave you that tea bowl, but I would like you to give it back to me now. Before you give it back, please have it glued together and have a box made for it. On the cover of the box, I ask that you write the name of the bowl, which I now give as the authentic tea bowl before birth. I will reverently pass the bowl on to my descendants." So that's the story. Maybe I need to put a little bookmark in here so we can refer back to it. So there are several themes, several very related themes that I want to talk about in this story. I think this is really a story about, form and emptiness, for starters, and the form, you know, of the tea ceremony and the tea and the form of the tea bowl. This would be, you know, a form that would be readily understandable to Japanese people even before this time. Since this time, the tea ceremony is a very structured activity that people take part in which. There are very specific forms, and it's a moment of letting go of other cares and really revering all the practices related to tea. And so, in this form, we can see that there's also a theme of maybe holding on to something, holding on to a tradition, or a bowl, versus breaking it, breaking the form, breaking the bowl. And I think that, so there's that theme. I think there's a theme of life and death in this too, the life and death of the tea bowl. You know, the tea bowl, you know, as it exists, you know, kind of before it's broken and then after it's broken. And what transcends life and death? So you know, brokenness and wholeness, and what transcends both of these states? And then finally, we have the three characters, Tetsugyu, Choon, and Lord Sendai. So we have, you know, Tetsugyu, who is conducting the form and holding on to the form of the tea bowl. He's maybe grasping this. He's revering this object and is unable to kind of regain his equilibrium when the tea bowl breaks. You know, he's pale and almost fainting. He's maybe a little too attached to this form and a little too attached to this bowl. we have the character of Cho'on, who kind of pushes the form away. You know, he breaks the bowl. He also breaks Tetsugyu's paradigm or ideal. And yet his response is maybe one-sided too. He's just, you know, let's get rid of the form. This is emptiness. Form is gone. You know, he stops short of caring for the form. So both of these characters in the moment are, we could sort of think of as presenting two different sides of something. One is, you know, grasping or holding on, and the other one is pushing away. And then we have Lord Sendai, who I think is able to really transcend the whole versus broken theme. You know, maybe Lord Sendai recognizes that there's something that really transcends birth and death, or whole and broken dualities. And in one version of the story, Lord Sendai, both. I'll get into that in a minute. So Lord Sendai is saying, you know, pick up the pieces of the bowl. You gather the pieces of the bowl, glue them back together, make a box for it, put a label on the box saying the authentic tea bowl before birth, and I will pass this along to my descendants. In the Japanese tradition, there is a tradition of gluing things back together and with gold, or with, you know, gluing them back together and then painting all the seams with gold to sort of highlight the wholeness that exists within the brokenness. And I think this is maybe part of the wabi-sabi aesthetic tradition, in which we can find, you know, beauty in imperfection or impermanence. It's sort of an acceptance that things are transient or imperfect, and that they are still nonetheless, you know, whole in some ways. So I thought I was kind of moved to talk about this because of two things that I think we're probably all aware of that happened this week. And one is, on Monday morning, I turned on the TV to watch the start of the Boston Marathon, as I often do on Marathon Day. And I'm kind of just, you know, watching them get ready. And I keep hearing the announcer talk about the push rim division, which is going to go first. And I was really struck by this because I hadn't heard this word before. You know, what the push rim division is it is what I think what I've previously heard called the wheelchair division, that there are athletes who are in wheelchairs and they go first in the Boston Marathon. And so, you know, there's sort of the men's division and the women's division. And I was really struck, though, by the use of the word pushrim, because when I hear wheelchair, and maybe this is true for you too, I hear something that implies brokenness, that there's some, you know, disability implied. And I don't hear that when I hear the word, pushrim. I hear something that I don't have any associations to. Yeah?
Push
rim. P-U-S-H-R-I-M. Yeah. And I looked it up, actually. So the push rim is that rim on the edge of the wheel of the wheelchair that you push on. But I don't, you know, I don't, I, and perhaps you are similar. You don't, I don't have the same associations. I didn't even really know what it was. And I was struck by how, for me, just the simple use of different language moves from a place of thinking about disability to a place of thinking about different ability, which is much more of a social justice model of disability. Because it takes the emphasis off of what the athlete can't do and puts the emphasis on something that the athlete can do. It brings me back to recognizing that, like, these people are in fantastic shape, first of all, that they can make it through 26.2 miles. And I couldn't do this. You know, I this is a different ability. So that was one way of thinking about, for me, you know, what is the wholeness that exists in imperfection? And the other thing that happened also on Monday, you know, just later that same day, my mom calls to tell me that Notre Dame Cathedral is burning to the ground. And I was just sort of dumbfounded. I have never been particularly attached to Notre Dame Cathedral. I've never been there. I've never really had a particular desire to go. But I suddenly just felt like, I don't think I can live in a world where we don't have Notre Dame Cathedral. I don't know. So, you know, it's just amazing to me that to think that an ancient form like this can be destroyed in an instant. And I was instantly, you know, thinking about what remains here. You know, fortunately, Notre Dame didn't burn to the ground, which I'm very happy about, because it really would have just completely, you know, unnerved me to think that this could happen. And I think that it's obviously really devastating to the French people. And, you know, since then I've heard that there are, you know, French wealthy business people who have pledged, you know, millions of euros to rebuild Notre Dame. And President Macron has said that they will rebuild Notre Dame within 5 years. And I'm fine with that. But I do have some slightly mixed feelings, you know, that there's, you know, part of me still feels like, you know, I don't think we can just put things back exactly the way that they were. And maybe there's a, you know, I don't know what the future of that will be. If they're going to try to build it exactly the way it was, they do have plans for pretty much everything. But anyway, you know, it brought me to the question of, you know, how can we use, well, it made me think of this story about the tea bowl, and made me think about, you know, how can we use this teaching in our life? So I want to talk a little bit about form and emptiness. So form, you know, we have forms. We have all kinds of things that are forms. We have, you know, rituals that are forms, like the tea ceremony or like any of the rituals that we do in our temple. You know, we bow to the room, we bow to the altar, we bow to our cushions. Forms are, they're not good, they're not bad, they are what they are. And sometimes we break the forms. And sometimes, you know, so there's form, and then there's emptiness. There's the lack of form. And emptiness is not good and it's not bad. You know, sometimes maintaining the form is the right thing to do. Sometimes breaking the form is the right thing to do. If we're in the middle of a ritual in the Zendo and somebody has an emergency, we need to attend to that person. You know, we need to maybe help. And so we break the form in order to be more effective. And I think that this is part of the teaching of the middle way between form and emptiness, that we, you know, that there are various things that we do or don't do. And we also talk, I guess, about equanimity, that there's a lot of talk in Buddhism about equanimity. And I think sometimes we can feel like, you know, equanimity is the goal. And it's certainly good. But the lack of equanimity isn't bad either. Because it can tell us things about our life. You know, sometimes we think we have equanimity and we don't recognize the things in the background of our life that are allowing us to have equanimity. I think a few weeks ago, I had just given a talk about patience, and I was feeling a little bit, you know, good about myself. Like, hey, you know, I've got all this patience. And the very next day, my 15-year-old cat started having seizures. And, you know, it took a while to figure out why this was happening. I think at first I was really, you know, very panicked. And you know, taking him to the vet constantly, and you know, we've kind of figured it out. And you know, the good and the bad news is that we got the seizures under control, but it turns out that he probably has a brain tumor, and that it set me off with a whole another, you know, set of panic. And I would notice, you know, in my Zazen that I'm just, you know, like I was all patient and I was all, you know, I had some stability, and now I'm like completely freaking out. Where did this go? You know, why can't I get my equanimity back? And, you know, it took me a few weeks to just be able to calm down and be able to, you know, kind of sit with all the uncertainty of this situation and begin to see how he, you know, he's not the same as he was, but yet is still whole, you know, feeling like there's this dichotomy between, you know, broken and whole. And, you know, this is true for each of our lives. You know, as to quote Bob Dylan, everything is broken. Everything in our lives is, you know, transient. And yet it's also everything is whole when we can accept things as they are. So, you know, even our very selves, we age and we don't like it, but really, as I'm always telling people now, you know, this is only what happens if you're lucky. if we're lucky, we get to grow old. You know, we get sick. We don't like it, but it happens, and we will, you know, we find a new equilibrium in that. We pass away. We find that, you know, things don't work as well as maybe they once did. And I think there's something to this story that can maybe help us think about, you know, how can we relax with this process? We sometimes, you know, if I think what has happened for me is I relax with this process when I feel like I'm in a moment of stability, and then I can, you know, I forget that it's happening for a while. But then something crops up again, and we're suddenly like, oh no, I, you know, why isn't this working the way that it used to? So I think that this story gives us a nice reminder of thinking about and pondering maybe what is the authentic tea bowl before birth. You know, all things arise from emptiness. You know, they arise from the causes and conditions that give rise to them. The grass grows because, you know, the earth has warmed up. We've got rain, we've got sun, and it's the conditions for grass to grow. Everything takes a temporary, life moves through all things, and it takes a temporary form, it flourishes for a while, and then it passes. And we can get lots of reminders of this in our lives, and maybe we can talk about this in a little bit. I want to quote Dogen on this, and this is something that you can find in Genjo Koan if you want to read along, or you can just listen while I read it. It's on page 16 and 17. So what Dogen has to say about this is, down at the bottom of the page, he says, firewood becomes ash, and it does not become firewood again. Yet do not suppose that the ash is future and the firewood past. You should understand that firewood abides in the phenomenal expression of firewood, which fully includes past and future and is independent of past and future. Ash abides in the phenomenal expression of ash, which fully includes future and past. Just as firewood does not become firewood again after it is ash, you do not return to birth after death. This being so, it is an established way in Buddha Dharma to deny that birth turns into death. Accordingly, birth is understood as no birth. It is an unshakable teaching in Buddha's discourse that death does not turn into birth. Accordingly, death is understood as no death. Birth is an expression complete this moment. Death is an expression complete this moment. They are like winter and spring. You do not call winter the beginning of spring, nor summer the end of spring. And I think what Dogen is talking about is things are as they are in the moment, and they could be very, very different the next moment. But birth is, it's just what's happening. There's no one, it has to do with there being no one thing that we can call birth. Birth involves a lot of different activities and causes and conditions, and there's no one thing that we can call death. And this is just the way it is. It's the burned parts of Notre Dame are now ash, and that is just, that's just ash. I thought the firewood metaphor was particularly apt for this week, but it just, this is the present. So the present is that things are different from how they were maybe last Sunday, but they are as they are. So, you know, the concept of the tea bowl can maybe be something that can help us to respond to the loss in our lives. You know, what is it that we hold dear and what are we attached to? It's not bad to be attached to things, but it hurts, you know, when we have to let go of them, as we inevitably will. We will ultimately have to let go of everything. And yet, you know, how do we find our way through that? So I think that practice or zazen can help us by giving us a little space where we can, you know, observe what's happening. You know, like I could observe that, you know, I'm completely freaking out about this situation, and observe my attachment and my clinging to that state. And it helps us to continue to just take a little bit of a step back and loosen our grasp, accept that our relationship to all the things in our lives is changing constantly. You know, causes and conditions arose to bring those things and us into the world and into contact with each other. And yet also, you know, the inexorable flow of conditions will break us apart. So, you know, maybe a big question from this story is, how can we gather up the broken pieces and carry on? You know, what is it that we, how can we live with these changing situations in our lives? So I think that's all I have to say. Maybe we can have a little bit of a discussion. But thank you for listening. So now is a time when we can talk about the story, or people can ask questions about really anything, especially people who are here for the first time or who just did Zazen instruction. Please feel free to ask questions about anything that you observed today. Oh, Hogetsu. Kathy?
I was just going to echo the meeting.
Yeah, that's a good question. Sure. You know, actually, Notre Dame has been deteriorating and being improved and changed over, you know, the 850 years since it was started. The spire that fell was something that I think was put up in the mid 18th century, and so that's actually a more modern, modernized piece of it. So I was kind of struck by that, and then I did a lot of reading about this and found that, you know, gargoyles have fallen off and been replaced by, you know, PVC pipes, and there's, you know, acid rain is destroying some of the stone. So you know, we had this one sort of macroscopic event that captured the attention of the world, but there have been all these little microscopic events that have been changing Notre Dame over, you know, the 850 years too. And so, yeah, when does something change so that it's no longer recognizable to us? But what does it change into?
What's it?
last Sunday, I came home and I had noticed that the kind of porcelain statue I have of Quan Chien in my garden was sitting on top of the table in my garden, which is not its usual place. And there were children running around. And the mother comes up to me and said, "I am so sorry. Our child smashed your statue." And I said, "Well, it looks pretty good up there." Cracked, you know.
Yeah.
But still, it looks kind of whole. And I was just like, "Wow, that's interesting," you know. And she said, "I'm so sorry." And, you know, the child's like, "No," and I said, "I think this is what children do when you leave statues laying around the garden. It can happen." But I've been like meditating on this because, you know, I thought, well, should I just like smash it? Glue it back together. Maybe I can get some gold that I can
right.
solder it back together. And so I just said, well, I don't want to do anything yet. I'm just going to let it sit there. You know, and it's interesting because actually on the wall of my brick garage, I have a mosaic that's made of smashed Serena, some of you may know her, she's a tattoo artist, but she made this mosaic made of smashed Chinese porcelain. It's really beautiful, so then it becomes something else, right? And so I've been just kind of meditating on this, you know, not quite knowing what to do with Quan Yin or Xi Shi. You know, because it's also like this, you know, Buddhist object. But anyway, it's an interesting thing that you bring that up. And
yeah.
The other thing, the response I had to, you know, what you were saying, Aishan, is that there is our delusion and our problems and our smashed pieces are the conditions for wholeness, like conditions for enlightenment. And Sinesh said this last week about, you know, our difficulties, psychological difficulties can be the gates to awakening. But it's also like, how do we have awakening if we're not deluded? You know, the cause of Buddha's coming into the world is our suffering.
Yeah.
So it's like, they're not, they're whole. We just see them as broken.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I just, you know, yeah. This is what you start off with. So
thank you for the reminder about Dharma gates. As we will be chanting later on, they're boundless, and you're right that things can seem broken to us and yet are whole. Everything is still all the same stuff, but we're both, you know, we're able to recognize that on the absolute, and yet we're able to you know, grieve and feel a loss of something on the relative or phenomenal. Gyoshin knows on.
So when I was ordained here, I was given an Urioki set of bowls, wrapped bowls that we use for our formal meals during retreats and so forth. And so there are four bowls, nesting bowls. The largest one is called the Buddha bowl. It's the one you don't use your chopsticks in because you poking Buddha in the face. And after a retreat last winter, I took my set home to wash it, and the Buddha bowl somehow slipped out of my hand, and it's made of very thick molded plastic. It's not fragile or anything, but somehow it just struck the floor at such an angle that it cracked. And so I was upset, and I washed everything else, and I came and asked Hagen, "What should I do?" And he said, "I'll throw it away." And I think that's a little shocking. But I think he did that because he thought I was just being attached to it. And it was his way of telling me I was a little attached to it. And he said, "If you want to do a ceremony,
yeah.
It's such a shocking picture.
Yeah.
I'll get back to you during your story.
Thanks. Yeah, we have a lot of attachments. Even if we don't know why. Nozad.
Well, yeah, I think you're, thank you for the, I forgot that story, and I appreciate bringing it up. I think the thing about Notre Dame is really particularly apt for this story, because when they talk, you know, yes, everybody's, I mean, I think that that feeling you had, many people had, maybe not been there or whatever, it's just, you know, but, and so you certainly understand the impulse to put Notre Dame together, back together with gold or whatever, as close as possible to the way it was. But this thing about the spire, which was built in the 19th century, I think, is, you know, has become this thing. It's like, well, do we put it back the way it was, you know, 100 years ago, or the way it was when Notre Dame was Notre Dame, you know, before the spire. And, you know, and what that sort of immediately raises is that there, in fact, isn't, you know, there isn't a Notre Dame.
Yeah, there's, yeah.
There are different phenomenal expressions of Notre Dame,
yes.
As there are with the teacup.
Yes.
And, you know, it seems like the two monks, you know, one, you know, has this, feeling that you know, something is irretrievably lost, and sort of rejects it. The other fellow seems to, you know, on some perhaps some misapprehension of what emptiness is about, seems to welcome that, you know, that, and seems to prefer the emptiness to form. Whereas Lord Sendai or whatever, and again, you're bringing up this passage of Billions. Yeah, you know, seems to have some sort of appreciation for the fact that that form and, you know, neither came nor went through that process, and neither did emptiness, right? They
mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
they're never, it's not like a clear away form, and what you're left with emptiness, no, as the Heart Sutra tells us, form is emptiness,
mm-hmm.
emptiness is form, and, you know, like with the firewood, you know, firewood exists only in the phenomenal expression of firewood. There's nothing, in other words, it's empty. There's nothing behind it that can, you know, then go somewhere else. Same with ash.
Yeah.
And so the question that it really, you know, raises, I think, the story is, what do we do not with the teacups and not with Notre Dame, but with our resistance to the reality of impermanence
mm-hmm.
and this endless proliferation of forms, none of which persist fundamentally, most importantly, from a psychological perspective ourselves. You know, we all suffer things and we try to pull ourselves back together. There's a range, and some are horrific. And, you know, others are just the natural process of growing up. You know, we think that, you know, putting ourselves back together, and it's like the question is, well, what's up? Where, you know, what are you pointing to here? And in fact, it turns out, if you look at it closely, you can't point to anything.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so thank you for the talk.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, everyone, for the talk and all the really discussion. I'm reminded, first of all, all of it reminds me of a story similar to one that I read, and I think it may have been a commentary on Rinzai. I'll have to paraphrase, but basically there are two monks on a mountain sitting, and one of them all of a sudden says, I found waking, I'm no longer attached to anything. And he goes down off to use the bathroom. And as the monk is gone, the other monk writes the name of the Buddha on the stone where he was sitting. And the monk comes back, and he's standing there, and he's like looking at this, and refuses to sit down on it. Sort of says, you say that you've lost attachment to things, but you're still attached to this notion of the Buddha as me. I refuse to sit on it. I think especially with what happened with Nathan on Monday, and since I've been thinking very deeply about impermanence and about sort of all of the things that we take for granted or that we don't realize, sort of Nathan, but also with all of the hastening effects of climate damage and all the change that's happening very visibly about mm-hmm. us. It's going to be terrifying because of all of these things that we thought we knew, that we thought were permanent, that we can look at for our whole lives, like our environment around us that have been, we think, the same as long as we can remember. And now all of a sudden they've changed, all of a sudden, and things aren't quite as recognizable as they were. And it, to me, was really very unsettling at first when you see that, because it's even if you sort of on a conscious level are thinking, you know, okay, well, I get some burden, that things change, but on some deep level there was still a feeling that you knew what this was and you had an idea of it, and it was here. But as you said very, very after long ago, underneath that word, the name, it's profoundly still changing. A word on things, so we've brain conceives of a notion of a thing, and I think though literally in every moment that thing truly is always shifting, and that the body as well, carbon comes in, carbon leaves, I'm just as much Lake Michigan as anything else, or whatever, but we sort of, there's this tendency to refuse to accept. It's sort of like this holding on to this perfect idea of what we thought the thing was, rather than keeping track of the reality of its ever-changing nature.
Thank you for highlighting that. I think this does have a lot to do with our concepts and our need to our wish to think that we know what something is or how something is supposed to be. And yet, that's just our concept. And the minute we have that concept, it's kind of past.
Hip-hop production techniques have a lot to teach us about this. Hear a song by anyone at any time, but just as an example, like a Herbie Hancock song, and then, you know, as a production technique, take parts of it, you know, it can teach us that the creative process of death is simultaneously the creative process of birth. You can take parts of this song, disassemble it, and reassemble it, or take just a certain section of it, and combine it with another song, and just take a certain section of that song, you know, disrupt the form of that song and create a new form based on those samples and have that be the life of, you know, the structure that supports, you know, 5 minutes of poetry on top of it, you know, like that will, you know, speak truth about a current context. Like, you know, in that particular example, that's Mobb Deep and Prodigy and Havoc, the producers and MCs on it. And really genius hip-hop producers can just make albums, entire albums, of just thousands of different, you know, songs that have been completely recontextualized and turned into something new. And that's just an example of that process that's happening all the time, all around us, mm-hmm. you know, of death becoming something else.
Yeah. I like that even better than the idea of trying to glue the T-bowl back together and make it a T-bowl. You know, can we glue it? I think I've heard of people making jewelry out of their wedding rings after a divorce, and they make some other kind of jewelry out of it, and wear it happily because it's just something different. You know, it's, they're not trying to keep it the same or make it into a different ring. It's just, you know, let's make something else. I love that. You know, how can we free ourselves up from our concepts of what something of thingness and let reality constantly flow. So, Miriam.
I couldn't help thinking of the man with Kohenheim. And he said, there is a crack in everything, that's how the light gets in.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Yep. And what happens with that light is not necessarily under our control. Maybe that's for the best. So we have time for maybe one more comment, and then we have to move on to the next form.
Yeah. Going off of like the motor com stuff, I just want to bring in like the whole field of art conservation, which is like next to the Art Institute. There's the conservation wing.
Yeah.
And so it's like every painting goes through there at some point, and it's always being put back together. I got to go in once, and it was crazy. They were talking about objects and like the lifespan of them. Well, this will be gone in 200 years, like we'll have to fix this, and this will only last this long, this will, and it's very much like they're always like beating back against the clock and just putting it back together. And that was really, really, really cool to see.
That is really cool. I watch a lot of Antiques Roadshow, and I'm always struck by, you know, when they have the appraiser come on and they'll say, you know, oh, this is one that you should restore. If you restore that, you could, you know, get, it would be worth much more. And then other things, they say, oh, no, don't restore that. It's going to totally destroy its value. And it seems totally arbitrary, you know. but anyway. We are going to just move into a completely different form, but thank you for a rich discussion.